If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
Welcome to the Career Vision Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Piff. And before we get things going here, Career Vision is our sponsor and the reason why we do this. Career Vision helps young people find their career paths, and current professionals who are looking for a change, they do so with these aptitude tests and a consultation with your results. So they talk about what you're good at, what you like to do, and what they think would work as a good career for you. They give you tons of options for you to go through. I did it myself. Unfortunately, I'm doing the right thing. And I know someone who has figured out what they're doing over a long period of time. Our guest today is Jimmy McInerney, a.k.a. Jimmy Mac, who's a longtime radio professional, audio producer, and podcaster. Jimmy, how's it going?
Great, Michael. Thank you for having me on your show.
So what we do with every episode of this is we start with a shout out to your high school.
Oh, my God.
Yes. You didn't see that coming, did you?
No.
Even if you didn't like it, it's fine.
Well, I'll shout out Loyola Academy.
All right.
On the North Shore.
What were you like at Loyola Academy?
Kind of a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know? It was interesting because when I went to Loyola Academy at that time, it was an all-boys Catholic school. And so without it being co-ed, you know, you think, well, oh, my God, that's terrible, right?
Yeah.
But in all actuality, it did kind of level the playing field amongst all of the students there.
Interesting.
I believe that it removed a lot of the pretense where guys were trying to impress girls by being something they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I got to really know people there. And I also felt like it removed the boundaries of
the cliques.
Cliques, yes.
Yeah.
So you would see geeks hanging out with jocks and, you know, musicians hanging out with nerds. You know?
Gotcha.
Things like that. And so I just felt like it made us all maybe a little more real with one another.
What were some of the things you were into then?
Things I was into?
Yeah.
Sports.
Mm-hmm.
I played on a few sports teams, music.
Yeah.
I love music.
What kind of music back then? What were you listening to then?
The same stuff.
Yeah.
Now, really, it's like a lot of rock.
You know,
a lot of rock, what people would call classic rock now. I guess we were starting to call it classic rock back then.
What would be on like, was there even an oldies station then? Like,
Yeah, like stuff my dad listened to. And then maybe there was some stuff that was in the 80s. I found the music of the 70s to be more interesting.
Yeah.
And I liked stuff with maybe a harder edge to it.
And were you also into radio at that time? Were you?
Oh, yeah.
What stations were you listening to?
My whole life. Okay, back then, probably primarily The Loop, Loop FM. And it wasn't until I got into college where I discovered The Loop AM, which was like all morning shows all day long.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So. How did that work?
Okay, well, you had The Loop FM.
Uh-huh.
And that was a legendary classic rock station here in town. And Jonathan Brandmeier was the morning guy. And before Johnny, it was Steve and Gary. And then it was music all day.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Stroud, middays, Bobby Scafish, afternoon drive, and a bunch of people at nighttime. And then they acquired AM 1000, Evergreen Media. And they wanted to make that into a show that reflected or into a station that reflected the type of programming that Johnny B was doing, that Steve and Gary were doing. And so it sort of became the flagship for Steve and Gary. That's where Kevin Matthews came into town then.
Mm-hmm.
Later, we brought in Danny Bonaducci to do evenings. And I say we because I was there at that time then.
Gotcha.
I was there for what I think was really the heyday of the Loop AM and all the talk radio of that time. And I worked on all of those shows.
So kind of going back a little bit, how did you get started on your path to radio? When were you like, I would love to work in radio and with audio?
Well, I knew that was something I wanted to do because I started playing around with it in high school.
Mm.
And we only had our so-called radio station at Loyola Academy was basically a PA speaker in the cafeteria. But still, we would produce shows. And that's where I sort of started to learn how to organize things like radio programming and stuff.
And like formatting what you were doing and outlining.
I produced my first commercials when I was like a sophomore in high school.
Whoa, what were those like?
They were really stupid and silly.
Yeah.
And with like sound effects, I would be doing live on the mic. Like, you know, I'd take a bite out of a taco. And so I would actually have tortilla chips in a baggie that I would squeeze to make it sound like that crunch. It probably would have been more effective just to eat the chips. But, you know, I was thinking in terms of that old school radio thing. When I grew up, the Jewel, you know, Jewel food stores. The Jewel had this premium promotion thing with cassette tapes of old-time radio shows. Fibber McGee and Molly, George Burns, stuff like that. There's this one where this guy had a closet. I can't remember what that was. But I enjoyed all of them.
You know,
Superman, the Green Hornet, all that stuff. And I really became very aware of the production value of all of that stuff.
Gotcha.
So that's where I think like a lot of it started, were those cassette tapes we got from the Jewels. But
man, I wish they were still selling that.
Yeah, right.
I mean, that'd be awesome.
I still have some of those cassettes.
Oh, really?
I do. Yeah, I do. My in my crawl space. I still do have those old cassettes. Who was the guy who had the closet? Oh, somebody listening knows.
Yes.
And they're yelling at right now.
Please email that to us. Find us. Just slap us with it.
McGee and Molly. That was it. Fibber McGee and Molly.
See, figured it out. Now you don't have to slap us.
Yeah.
So after Loyola Academy, you go to school.
Yes.
Where'd you go?
Okay, so I didn't really have direction. I was not the greatest student at Loyola. I was not very focused. And so in the summer between my senior year of high school and my freshman year of college, I went to Northwestern University to go to this week-long seminar series.
Interesting.
About note-taking.
Whoa.
Like college-level note-taking. What to do when you're sitting in the classroom and you're hearing those lectures and you have a pen and a notebook. What do you do? You know, instead of just scribbling down things. I mean, they really taught me a lot about organizing my thoughts and taking notes in a way which then I could easily review them for exams and things like that. So this is the first time I ever am like taking school seriously for some reason.
What kind of clicked in for you where this is like, hey, I'm getting this. This is kind of you're soaking it more for that week. What was the reason for that?
I think my mom wanted me to go.
Yeah.
I think it was my mom who probably insisted I go. Because I graduated high school by the skin of my teeth.
Oh, okay.
I really had to work. Like when the second half of senior year, when most people are going through their so-called senior slump.
Right.
I was doing like extra workload for school because my grades were so bad. And it's not like I'm sitting here on microphone saying I was too stupid for high school.
No.
It wasn't that.
No.
I wasn't applying myself. I was too rebellious. I was too anti-authority. I was too much of a know-it-all.
Mm-hmm.
But then when my back got up against the wall, I really was able to shine, and I graduated, believe it or not, with honors. So it was—
So you were developing that work ethic in the back half of your senior year, right? And that kind of really pushed you to be
there. It was like playtime was over, I guess.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really getting along well with the dean of students there, and he did not like me.
This sounds like a movie from that time period, yeah, well, doesn't it?
You know what's very interesting is during that time period was the same time John Hughes was putting out his movies like Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, etc. And John Hughes is from Northbrook, and that's the suburb I grew up in.
Oh, interesting.
And so he was actually shooting those films, exterior shots, in and around the north suburbs.
Yeah.
And he's shooting all those movies, exterior shots, like in my neighborhood, you know, and right down the street from my house and in the surrounding suburbs. And yet the scene from the end of Breakfast Club where Judd Nelson is walking across the football field and he lifts his fist up. That's Glenbrook North High School.
Oh.
Literally 2 blocks from my house. And so we're watching these movies, and they're all being released while we are in high school. And the beginning of The Breakfast Club, he says Shermerville. I think he says, Shermerville 60062. Shermerville was the original name of Northbrook back when the settlers were there.
Oh, that
is. And the zip code 60062 is still the zip code for Northbrook.
What a cool Easter egg.
I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
And so there's all these things. Like, my brother can take you on a tour of all the John Hughes shooting locations. He knows them all. And some of them, you know, there's like maybe a park bench with a plaque on it or something. Mm-hmm. Just in some places to signify. I was driving to school one day, and I saw John Candy standing outside of New Trier West High School getting ready for a shot. And I'm just driving right by, and there he is, big as life, John Candy. So naturally, then, we thought all those movies were about us. And so
it felt that way. Huh?
So we felt like it was okay to express ourselves and to get into trouble and to do all the things that they were doing in the movies.
Right.
Because we thought those movies were about us.
You
anyway,
and Anthony Michael Hall. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. I've had many Anthony Michael Hall moments in my life, believe me. But so that's just a little tidbit about like what that era was like going to high school for me, you know, heavily social, like a very social kind of situation always happening, big parties at houses, sometimes very nice houses on the North Shore where it's like, I can't believe that
we're here right now.
Nothing but teenagers in here and 3 kegs in the kitchen. Oh. You know, that's just how it was.
If
my kids acted like that, I'd have a heart attack. But it was par for the course back then, you know?
Yeah. So then college, you get there and you're trying trying to figure out what you're going to do, which kind of fits into what our sponsor does. Career Vision is like people who don't know what they're doing, kids who don't know what they're doing, or professionals that are looking for something different. You can take these tests and they tell you, hey, these are things that you're interested in, and here's what you're good at.
Yeah.
So, like, but here you're trying to figure that out while you're in college.
Yeah, it was. I always knew I wanted to do something creative.
Yeah. Yeah. That
I wouldn't settle for anything like business school, which I suggest everyone should take some business courses at least. But that just didn't appeal to me. Being a sales guy or a corporate executive didn't appeal to me. Nor did blue collar work. That didn't appeal to me either. I wanted to work in a creative field.
Yeah.
And I, as a kid, always grew up playing around with recording devices and making recordings and, you know, everything from fake radio dramas to fake radio shows, newscasts.
Yeah.
You know, I'd be talking up a Beatles album and, you know, I mean, just goofing around.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd play back. I'd be like, ooh, that sounds so good, you know, and it's like my voice is squeaking and stuff. But I was just having fun with all of that. And especially when the cassette tapes really started to become the format.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just like you could just keep playing around with these tapes. And then if you don't like what you do, you can erase it and do it again. And so I was always playing around in like having dreams of having a studio, a recording studio and stuff. And I was never into like video. I was never into that really.
No.
I am now. I do a lot of video work now, but I never considered like TV. And I always think that's because when I grew up, I had really poor eyesight.
Okay.
Thanks to, you know, LASIK and things like that. I can see great now, but yeah. As a kid, I was never really
you weren't running home to MTV. Basically.
No, I wasn't like a visually driven person. You know, I was more into audio and sounds and things like that. And so I went to Columbia College after a year of really not knowing what I wanted to do. But I went to Columbia College on the advice. I was working at a shopping mall, Northbrook Court. And one of the guys there who's the manager of this silly little gift shop I worked at, he told me, he's like, hey, you know, Columbia College, all the things you talk about, they will help you find a professional career doing the
That's
things.
That's interesting.
So I was like, really, Columbia College? And so I went there for summer school. And the thing is, when we were using reel-to-reel tape back then, this is before. Before digital. Yeah, 1988. So this is before digital. And they gave me a razor blade and a reel-to-reel machine. And it was like they just sat me there.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh my God, I know what to do. Like I started recording and cutting the tape and splicing it together and all this stuff. And I was like, this is the first time I've ever sat down to do it. And I know how to do it. How is it?
Because you've been playing with that, right?
Well, it's just a version of it. There's just something like gave me this natural inclination to do audio production.
Oh, that's cool.
And so I was like, oh my God, this is, I know how to do it. And this is the first time I'm sitting down to do this. I better pursue this, you know? And so I did, and at Columbia College, I kind of stood out, I think, a little among my classmates. But then I got this urge to go to a university, and I had friends going to University of Kansas.
Okay.
And I visited them, and we went on this canoe trip in Missouri, and we did all of this fun stuff. And I really got along with all these kids who were friends of my friends who were going to University of Kansas, and they're like insisted I enroll there, that it would be the best thing I ever did and all this stuff. And so I did. And I was there for a couple of years and I had a lot of fun, but just the call of Chicago, just I couldn't help, and I wanted to go back. So I'd come back for summer school at Columbia College. And then I'd go back to Kansas.
Well, when you were at Kansas, were you still able to study audio, radio, media, and things like that when you were there?
So I hooked up with their radio station, KJHK, Lawrence, Kansas.
Lawrence, Kansas.
It was like 88 point something, I don't know. Yeah. But it was a really good station, like really well run. And the facility was this little house on campus that was this tiny house, but there was a room in there with, you know, it was a radio studio and then a wall of vinyl and all of this. And I was really a bad DJ back then. Back then, I just felt like I was overwhelmed by it all.
Do you remember what your first couple shows were like? Because now you have me thinking terrible. About when I first did, because I was incredibly shy. People probably didn't realize it, but I wanted to do radio so bad. Yeah. And I went to Augustana and I did the college radio there, WAUG, W-A-U-G, and for some reason, I loved it immediately. Mm-hmm. I wasn't necessarily playing what they wanted me to play, but I was still doing that and having fun doing it, and kind of that stuck with me. But like, so you're doing it the first couple times.
Yeah, it was bad because they had this wall of vinyl.
Yeah.
And you would have to play according to their rotation that they had, their format. You would take it from the one bin, and then you would take one from the three bin, and then you would take one from the five bin, and then you'd have to queue it up on the turntable, and all this is going on, and I'm like panicking, you know? I'm like, I can't do this fast enough. This is crazy. So I then started bringing in stacks of my own CDs.
There you go.
They had a CD player, and that was much easier. That was much easier. Nowadays, I could do the vinyl, whatever. I could. But yeah. It was stressful for me, and I was panicking. And I don't think I had a very good on-air presence. And, you know, you had to be careful because you're like 18, 19 years old, smart ass. And you don't want to say something to offend people.
And what time was your show when you were doing it?
Oh, God, it was like... There was one shift I had. It was Fridays, like late afternoon to early evening. And then there was a morning shift. It was like Monday and Thursday morning. So, I mean, it was just scattershot all over the place. I was lucky to get one shift at all. But I never really connected with the whole culture of the radio station. You know, there's these upperclassmen who kind of acted like their you-know-what didn't stink.
Yeah, their way or the highway type people.
And they all really thought that they were just the greatest thing since sliced bread, man.
So if we're comparing these to 80s movies, these are the outsiders and these are the socias, right? And then
I was definitely the greaser.
You're the greaser in that one?
Yeah, the greaser at the bottom of the fountain.
So Pony Boy in this one?
Yeah, I was definitely being held under the water in the fountain in the town square, you know.
So then you come back to Chicago.
So I came home because I was just really homesick.
Yeah.
It was getting to a point where a lot of my friends dropped out. So I was like, oh, great. All my friends are gone. So I didn't have any roommates anymore.
Well, you were last man standing then, right?
Yeah,
at least you won in some sort of way.
They all dragged me out there.
Yeah.
And then they, one by one, they all just got picked off and they were gone. And then I was rooming with this guy and I didn't really care for the guy. And he was stealing from me and stuff. It was just
lame.
It was lame, and he was a real farm boy, this guy, and, you know, I mean, it's Kansas.
Right.
And there's no knock on it. I loved it out there, and I met people in Kansas, and these, you know, a lot of guys, they did grow up on farms, you know, and there was like this tough edge to them that, you know, these guys are out in the fields at 5 a.m. and stuff, and I'm sleeping off a hangover. But, you know, I just couldn't – I just didn't fit in.
Right, right.
My story a lot of times is I just never really would fit in, you know.
Misfit toy kind of
thing. A little bit.
Yeah.
A little bit. Growing up in Northbrook, I grew up like right on the corner of Northbrook and Glenview.
Oh, okay.
So I went to school in Glenview, and I was like the only kid from Northbrook who went to school in Glenview.
Gotcha.
So – The Glenview kids treated me kind of like an outsider, and the Northbrook kids never even got to know me.
Mm.
I didn't start hanging out with Northbrook people until midway through high school, and they were telling me places, well, let's go meet up here, and I'm like, well, where is that? And they're like, you don't know where that is? I thought you grew up in Northbrook. Well, really, I grew up in Glenview, if you want the honest to God truth. Even though I have a Northbrook address, and then of course, growing up a Sox fan. In the North Shore back then. So I went to Catholic school, and Sister Veronica went around the room and asked everyone who their heroes were. This is third grade. And when they got, like, the kids were saying Bill Buckner, Chet Lemon, Manny Trio. When they got to me, I said Chet Lemon. And Sister Veronica accused me of making up the name.
What?
And
you didn't have Google back then to show her.
And demanded I say someone else. I think I then said, well, if I can't have Chet Lemon, it's going to be the $6 million man. She's like, that's not real. It was a whole scene. So like I said, I was kind of like this square peg all the time.
Hey, as a Sox fan growing up in Lake Zurich, I kind of get it. Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a handful of us, and when they won the World Series, we just kind of hat-tipped each other. That was it. But... So you're going by the beat of your own drum when you're
pretty
in
much,
that way,
always,
right?
Always, yeah.
Yeah. And then you're back in Chicago, and you are pursuing radio at this point.
Yeah. Well, now I'm at Columbia College.
Columbia College.
I survived KJHK
Survived.
KJHK.
Yeah.
I survived.
Yeah.
And was ready to take it up the next level, and that's when I fell in love with what they had going on at The Loop.
Mm-hmm.
I had always known Jonathan Brandmeier, grew up listening to him when I was in high school. But guys like Kevin Matthews, I just remember coming home from school, my brother saying, you should listen to this. They're doing a lot of funny Chicago stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, okay. And I turn on Kevin Matthews, and within the first few seconds, I hear he's talking to Pat Foley, and Kevin's playing sound effects of the goal horn and stuff like that. Back then, that was like revolutionary. You know? I was like, oh my God, this is great. You know? And it was funny and energetic and stuff. And so as I was going through the classes at Columbia College, and really, really, you know, I don't want to blow my own horn, but there was – you know, I could tell I was on a level above just about everyone else in that school.
Right.
I was in the same classroom with a few people who were also up on that level too. And some of them still have careers in Chicago
That's
radio
cool.
to this day. Russ Matera over at The Score.
I know Russ.
Me and him were in the same class at Columbia College. Yeah.
That's cool.
And it was a tight-knit class too.
Yeah.
We would hang out like after the class and we would get together on weekends and stuff. It was like a tight-knit class.
As a radio nerd, also someone who did promotions and stuff, I'm nerding out over that right
yeah.
now.
Oh,
that
yeah.
you both doing that is really, really
well,
cool.
Well, I didn't know, you know, I mean, once we left school, I didn't really keep in touch with him or know where he was until I was at WCKG, which was owned by CBS Radio, just like The Score.
Yeah.
And me and Dan Hampton were doing LASIK eye surgery promotions together. Me and him, of all people, you know. The station wanted somebody, because I told you I had the really bad eyesight.
Yeah.
And so I got the LASIK surgery through a radio promotion with WCKG. And they come to me then after it's all done. They're like, well, you have to go do a commercial at The Score with Dan Hampton. And I'm like, you're kidding me. This is great. Me and the Danimal on a commercial together. Fantastic. So I go over to The Score. This is there in the NBC building.
Yeah.
And Hampton's there, and Russ is there, and I was like, I'm like, I know this guy. And right away, he goes, Jimmy Mack, remember, from Columbia College?
Oh, cool.
I'm like, holy smokes, I cannot believe that you're that guy, you know? And so he's like, yeah, I've been following your career. And I'm like, oh, my God,
That's
I feel like
cool.
such a jerk. I haven't been but since then, you know, and Russ is like one of these really, like, top level.
Oh, his voice is one of the like most distinct.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you just know you've heard it before.
He's got a great voice and obviously killer work ethic and everything. And so like we kind of came out of that same class together.
Yeah.
Then I got involved in the internship program with Columbia College. And they told me Dave Benson at The Loop needed help in the music library.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, okay, I'm your man.
So unpaid internship?
Unpaid.
Yep. Hey, I had two too. I didn't get paid either.
Yeah, I didn't get paid a dime.
Right.
But I made out like a bandit with record albums and CDs.
Amazing.
Which were really a priority for me back then. Even if I made money from the internship, I would have spent it on albums and CDs. So it kind of worked out. As a matter of fact, I got so many albums and CDs from this internship that I would stop at Secondhand Tunes in Evanston on my way to work, sell them a stack of CDs, go to the gas station, put gas in my tank so I could afford to get to the internship. The unpaid internship.
So it all worked out.
Yeah.
It all worked out.
See, I mean, you got to be resourceful sometimes.
So this internship, what all were you doing? What were you learning?
It was basically just putting the music away and making sure everything was where it was supposed to be.
Yeah.
So I couldn't be caged up in that music library.
No.
So after a couple weeks, I started poking around the radio station a little bit. And I'd be like, oh, my God, there's Steve Dahl. You know, oh, my God, there's Kevin Matthews. There's Chet Copic. Oh, my God. And so I'm having all these moments just trying to be cool.
How do you stay cool in that?
Well, the thing that helped was there were many interns at The Loop back then, all about my age.
Yeah.
And some of them I already knew from Columbia College anyway, especially in the sports department. They had probably 10 interns in there.
Okay.
And so that kind of made it easy for me then as like a lone wolf to kind of, you know, navigate around the station without anybody going, why have you left your post? You know, aren't you supposed to be filing albums? But then I started talking to people, and one of the people I started talking to was a guy named Shemp DeYoung, who was Kevin Matthews' producer, and he told me that his intern was going to be taking off for a few weeks.
Okay.
Would I fill in? And I'm like, okay, well, this is what I've been waiting for. So not only did I fill in covering for that intern, I stayed at the station for like 12 hours each day, just hanging out in the studio, talking to people, letting people see me. There was a production room, Studio C, that I fell in love with, and just there was a lot of work to be done because everything was reel-to-reel tape back then, and you would dub to archive the comedy bits they were doing on the air and save them for best-of shows and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
You would have to dub the highlights from a beta tape onto a reel-to-reel tape in real time and then edit it with a razor blade. So it was time-consuming, you know?
Yeah.
And so in that case, there was always, always tons of work to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So I could go and hang out at the station for 12 hours and keep myself very busy, and nobody's going to say anything to me. But people did start noticing, you know?
Hey, which is a good thing. Time.
Yeah, well, that's what I wanted. That's what I wanted.
Yeah.
And then when the kid came back,
mm-hmm.
they let him go. I feel bad about that. But
you Wally pipped him.
Well, no, there was a sports analogy. It had something to do with a quarterback, maybe the Bears. I can't remember.
Okay.
This is like 1991.
91.
Maybe Eric Kramer was, I can't remember.
Not Harbaugh?
But
Harbaugh
it was,
or Flutie,
it was something
right?
that Shemp said to me
yeah.
about, you know, well, you know, sometimes the replacement becomes the full-time player.
Well, I would say like that's Lou Gehrig. You were Lou Gehrig.
I was Lou. Yeah, Wally picked Lou Gehrig. Okay, that's fine. Let's
see, I just went too far back. My bad.
No, you did. Well, there was a specific sports analogy that was mentioned at the time, but
it sounded
that's
good.
The Wally Pip is good. Let's stick with the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Lou Gehrig.
All-timer.
Greatest players of all time.
Yes.
So, so then I just really became part of the Kevin Matthews Show fabric, you know, and I took my, you know, lumps from Kevin and from Steve Dahl. Steve Dahl used to call me Beaver Cleaver, you know. Steve goes, hey, looks like Beaver Cleaver over there, because I was young. I was like 20. And Gary Myers like, yeah, Beaver Cleaver, if he's out working the streets at night.
Wow.
like, you got to understand, though. And I'm sitting in the studio right next to him, you know, looking at him through the window. And there's two ways you can go with these situations. You can get intimidated and be, you know, like a turtle and put your head in the shell.
Yeah.
Or you can embrace the comedy and just start laughing.
Also, they're talking about you on the radio, which
well,
is also cool, right?
That was it. But some people crumbled. Some people did crumble. They took it too personally, or they got their feelings got hurt, or they just got overwhelmed by the medium, which happens.
Yeah.
People get overwhelmed by the medium. I'm way too comfortable in the medium. I should get overwhelmed more often like I used to when I was younger, but I'm just too comfortable in it now.
I remember when they first started letting me come on here on WGN Radio, and the first time I went on with Anna DeVlantis, and I think I felt like... like in high school when like I'd have like some of the back of my knee was like twitching.
Oh,
I'm like, that
leg.
Feeling came back.
Yeah.
But I still kind of like, I don't know if people notice it as I was talking, but I felt like I was, you know, giving a presentation in high school again.
Yeah.
And then getting reps with, which our hosts, they are so good at making you feel comfortable.
The
like
best.
They're incredible at it. And that's kind of getting those reps help there. You were just good off the bat. You're the natural here.
Who?
You.
Me?
You apparently,
when,
right?
Where?
Well,
oh,
you're
no,
getting...
like, I had to grow into that, like
okay.
I'm saying.
Yeah.
Like I'm saying. I'm too comfortable in it now.
Yeah.
Because, like, my whole family is radio and everything else. But back then, you know, I did... there was a sense of awe and intimidation and...
but you also grew up... you grew up a fan of this stuff, too.
I did. Yeah.
Yeah.
I did. Huge fan. Huge fan. So the Kevin Matthews thing went on for about a year, and things started to get there was a shakeup at the Loop.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny Brandmeier was sick of doing mornings on the FM.
Mm-hmm.
He was simulcast on FM and AM in the mornings.
Oh, that's
back
cool.
then. And he was sick of waking up early and wanted to do afternoon drive. So they wanted to put Johnny on afternoons on the AM station.
Gotcha.
And put Steve Dahl on mornings on the FM station.
Okay.
And then, and I think Steve was simulcast on, it was Steve and Gary. They were simulcast AM and FM, but then they split up.
Oh, man.
They split up.
So who went where? Just for my, because I didn't know about this back then.
Oh, my God. It was such a big deal. They got into a big fight when Gary got married.
Uh-oh.
Gary Meyer got married.
Gary got married.
Yeah, and went on to his honeymoon. This is circa 1993, I want to say. And Gary went on his honeymoon and then came back from the honeymoon and had one of the producers of the Steve and Gary show pull all of the tapes of the shows from when Gary was gone, and he scrubbed through all of them and heard unflattering comments about his wedding and his new bride and stuff. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And so Gary wanted to go solo.
Don't blame him.
And it was a really big deal because they were a top rated show.
Mm-hmm.
And there were all these changes happening at the radio station, and there were syndication. I wasn't in on any of these meetings,
right?
But I think they were lining up syndication packages for Steve and Gary and everything, and all that went out the window. Now, I wasn't in on those meetings, but one day I was working late at the Loop. Nobody else was around.
Yeah.
And I walked over to the mailroom, and I heard from the program director's office, loud voices.
Mm.
Okay. And so I eavesdropped and I basically heard Steve and Gary breaking up. They were on, it was on a speakerphone. It was on a speakerphone.
Okay.
And there were two of the top executives at the Loop in that office, and Steve and Gary were on the speakerphones, and there was no resolution to be had. And I got my ear up against the door listening to this.
Oh my goodness.
Going, this is it. It's hitting the fan right now. And then, you know, I stood there as long as I could. My heart started beating. I'm like, I gotta go. If they find me with my ear up against the door, I'm a dead man. And I kept that information to myself all those years. I never, like, told anybody.
I'm so glad you just shared it on this podcast.
Well, you know, it was 30.
Yeah.
What are they going to do, fire me?
Exactly.
So, it was amazing. And then, one other time I was in a production room, and this is when AM 1000 was blowing up and going all sports.
Mm.
And they were bringing people into the production room next to me and firing them.
Whoa.
One after another, and I could see it happening through the windows.
Gosh.
And also, I could turn the microphones on in that room, and I did. And I recorded three or four people getting fired.
Oh, my goodness.
And I'm sitting there eavesdropping on all of this. Do you believe this?
I can't believe it.
Do you believe the sloppiness?
Well, I'm just trying to – I'm remembering getting laid off and what that was like,
yeah.
But for that to happen in that way. Like, mine was over the phone. It's in the middle of COVID, so you had to do it over the phone. It couldn't be personal. But, like, you had your HR person on the call and your boss who feels really bad about it because it is layoffs. It's not getting fired.
Yeah, they weren't being mean about it.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
But it was
it's
hard.
Still heartbreaking, though.
Yeah, and I ended up destroying those tapes because I felt weird about having them.
Yeah.
I felt weird. I kind of like to listen to him now, actually hearing myself talk about it. But the way the station was laid out, you had Studio A production, Studio B production, and in the middle of those two studios was this little voice booth.
Okay.
Where you could put maybe three or four people in there. And if they wanted to record an interview or something, or, you know, put voice talent in there. But that's where management chose to fire people.
No conference
and
room
I'm
or
in
anything?
And I'm in the studio right next door looking right through the window at them while they're doing it and listening. They didn't know I was listening.
But they knew you were there, right? Because they could see you?
They knew I was there.
Okay.
But I mean, there was, you know, a wall and a window between us. I wasn't supposed to be hearing. These are supposed to be soundproof rooms.
Jeez.
That's why I think they did it.
Okay.
Because they were soundproof.
They thought they were covered, basically, literally.
Well, I mean, all I had to do was just turn the microphone on.
Yeah.
There was no, like, light in the studio or anything. There was a light in the hallway. But they were in the studio. They didn't see.
That's so weird to think about, though.
But it's just, and it's kind of ballsy on my part.
I never
even played them back or anything, and then I ended up trashing them. but these are things that happen at radio stations, you know?
Yeah.
And back in the day, when things were analog and there weren't computers or smartphones, there was a lot of chicanery going on.
The way you just say chicanery, one of those Chicago type of words you could do there.
Yeah, it was a situation of chicanery here.
So Brandmeier is moving to afternoons.
So he's moving to afternoons,
yeah.
And Jimmy Weiser, who was Johnny's longtime producer, was moving on.
Gotcha.
He was going to produce some other radio show or something, or he went to TV. I can't remember what the circumstances were, but they needed somebody to replace Jimmy Weiser. And those were big shoes to fill, so they hired a few of us.
Okay.
They brought in Artie Kennedy, who was already on Jonathan Brammeier's staff. And then they had Carol Harmon and Catherine Beckman, who worked in Johnny's production office. They then started to become more involved with the show, booking guests, screening calls, etc. And Artie was kind of like in studio technical help.
Okay.
Like, so if Johnny was looking for a tape or something, Artie would usually help him out with that or something. And then I was in the production studio next to them, and I was making all the wacky sounds and movie drops and news bites and all that stuff. I was just like in heaven doing all of this production work. And it was much more, Jonathan Brammeier was much more professional the way he ran his show compared to anyone else I ever worked with.
What are some of those differences? What was he doing?
Well, laser sharp focus on his part for one thing.
Yeah.
Like he always knew exactly what he wanted when he walked into the studio. Some show hosts that I worked with would be like, oh, buddy, I don't know. What do you want to do?
Oh,
you know? And I would like, what do I want to do? This is your show. But we could try this or that or whatever. But Brammeier always knew, and we always would plot out what we were going to do.
Yeah.
And also the thing with Johnny's show was nothing was ever fake or made up. I mean, we did wacky characters and stuff that was so obviously cartoony that, I mean, but like the things the listeners would do, the crazy antics of callers and situations around the show. And Johnny would always say, I'm not going to ever ask you to do something I wouldn't do myself.
Okay.
But sometimes it would be like, you know, like roller skating in your underpants down Michigan Avenue. You know, of course Johnny would do that.
So
but
you,
I don't want to do that. No, I didn't do that. Okay. I did not do that. I was not ever the guy who wanted to put myself in a position of being like the radio punching bag or the whipping boy. Too many people.
Brian Peruke.
Well, I mean, okay, not – that is kind of
I'm sorry. That's a that's
Brian.
A name drop people probably didn't expect. But
Brian. Yeah. No, I like Brian. I've known Brian
I'm just saying that was
time.
His nickname though, right, at Q101?
Yeah. Well, they called him whipping boy. And then Wendy and Bill got – him on their show.
Okay.
When they were hosting mornings at Q101. And they didn't, Bill Left didn't like calling people by their nicknames.
Uh-huh.
He would always, so he wanted to call Whipping Boy Brian.
Brian.
But nobody had ever called him Brian on the air.
And the listeners weren't used to that, right?
No, he was Whipping Boy. And there was this, it was like a character almost. But then he really did become a real person. He became Brian. And I think that his whole career has benefited from that, as opposed to just being the whipping boy for your whole career.
I will say, so little tangent here. When I interned at the Score, he was the nicest person.
Yes.
Always like very accessible, answered any questions I had, which treated me like a human, even as an intern and stuff like that. And a couple times running into him afterwards, like, was very like helpful in my career. So I think Brian Peruke, I haven't talked to him in years and years and
me
years,
neither.
But he's someone that I would say I'm grateful for having met before.
Well, that's like wonderful.
But that's part of this business too, is the people you meet along the way who've been in your position before and want to help you get there too. So sorry, just wanted to say that while we had, I don't think I'm ever going to get to talk about Brian Peruke again on a podcast. So I just needed to get that out in case he was to ever listen to this.
Yeah, this is supposed to be about me anyway.
It is what about is it? You, Jimmy.
Whipping boy.
Jimmy at the loop.
Hijacking my interview. But I did it to myself. But like I said, I didn't want to be that punching bag.
Yeah.
I never did.
You didn't want to be Jackass on MTV,
no,
right?
Yeah. No. And then so at the Loop, I met Wendy Snyder.
I was going to ask.
Yes.
You met Wendy at the Loop.
Yes. And I remember the first time I ever saw her. I remember the first time I ever talked to her. I remember the first time we ever went out. I mean, all that stuff. It all happened there. But I was, you know, back to being intimidated again. It took me the longest time to ask her out because
really?
She was Wendy Snyder.
Yeah.
You know, and I was Johnny B's whipping boy. No.
Well, so where did you kind of find your in? Where did you get, how'd you get comfortable enough to do that?
So with Johnny, we were going back and forth to broadcast from LA.
Oh, okay.
So, and that went on for like 4 years.
Wow.
Okay. So from like 93 to 90, maybe even 5 years, 98, you know.
Well, so what were you guys doing in LA?
Well, Johnny was trying showbiz options for his career.
Yeah.
You know, I think he wanted to have more of a television presence, and he did some incredible stuff on NBC.
Yeah.
And CNBC, and filling in on later with Bob Costas when Bob couldn't be there. He did all kind of things, man.
Interesting.
And it's just like, he is the one, like, guy who I thought would have an incredible television career, but his true gift is really radio, and that's what he does better than anybody else. I've never been in the studio with anyone who could hold a candle to Jonathan Brandmeier. No way, man. He was just the Michael Jordan. I mean, just the things he would do live on the air with sound effects and his own voice and the people around him and just the way everything he would incorporate this swirling madness into a radio show was just amazing. And I've stayed connected with him and worked with him on and off for over 30 years now, you know?
Wow.
And, I mean, we had a podcast going before I started here at WGN that we were doing during the pandemic.
Okay. Which we will get into your podcasting prowess in a little bit.
Oh, my God.
But yeah, but back to Wendy.
So I met Wendy at The Loop, and yeah, then we finally started, we became a thing, you know, and that was just great. And, you know, that's probably a big reason why I never wanted to be that punching bag on the air.
Yeah.
Is because I feel like, well, I'm kind of representing her too in a way. You know?
Interesting.
And I even feel that way in the hallways here at WGN and stuff. Because
that's really,
I mean,
sweet.
There's nobody who loves WGN more than Wendy Snyder.
Yeah.
I mean, she is the biggest fan of this station, and she just has this connection to, WGN that I, you know, it's just perfect. She's local. She's always lived in the area her whole life. Mm-hmm. She's never been on the air in other cities or anything. She's always been Chicago. I think that's incredible. Since 1986.
That's amazing.
Since 1986, she's never had to, you know, pack up and move to Chattanooga or Des Moines or wherever people, you know, Iowa City, who knows, you know, I mean, it's always Chicago.
The last time I was on air was actually with her. No, I think 2 times ago, but was the most comfortable I've ever been on the radio before. We're just talking about Italian beef. But she made it so fun, and I felt like I was talking to a family member. Yeah. Like I felt like I was literally at like a family picnic with mostaccioli baking over on the side and stuff like that. But that was,
she's got the mostaccioli baking. That's for sure. But you know, it's I don't mind saying.
Do you find both being in the industry, like, does that help? You know, like kind of understanding each other from a professional standpoint, but also, you know,
yeah. But sometimes you never get a break from radio.
That's true. Right. You can't get, you can't take a break
from
the work.
And then also there's
then, huh?
Sometimes when like one of us will maybe overstep the boundaries a little bit, when it comes to applying advice or criticism or
that's, I mean, interesting,
you know, it's
that's
like
a podcast that needs to happen.
You two
I'm just saying that'd be fun to listen to.
We had a podcast for many years called Snide Remarks Radio.
I'm so sorry I didn't know that.
Oh yeah.
And I have to go back and find it.
It was like you know, 10 12 years ago, maybe even more, but we did a whole bunch of episodes. We did live shows at bars and stuff. It was just fun.
So I guess that's something we ought to, good transition here. Yeah. Podcasting, I think, wasn't really taking off by the, like, until maybe like mid 2010s, but you were in on the ground floor, it seems like 2009, right? That was about when you started.
No, I even earlier than that. Podcasting in 2006.
2006. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so what got you into, like, got you interested in, hey, I'm going to try this?
Okay. I'm a big Star Wars fan.
Yes, we haven't even started that.
my whole life. Yeah. I love Star Wars. And there were websites and stuff devoted to Star Wars. Mm-hmm. I always wanted to be kind of involved in organized fandom from what it was back then. You know, now it's a whole mainstream thing. But back then it was very, very niche and you had to really find it. And this was before George Lucas created the prequels and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And so I started to, poke around at these websites and stuff. And then around 2005, I saw a Star Wars podcast. And I listened to it. I was like, what is this podcast? So I played it, and I'm like, oh, God. It sounded awful.
So it was on a website.
Yeah. I'm like, this is total amateur hour stuff. Uh-huh. And so I got real snotty,
Yeah.
Podcasting, I'm a broadcaster. Things like that,
You gotta use the, I'm a broadcaster.
Oh, God. Super snotty.
Yeah.
But I went to a Star Wars convention in Indianapolis in 2005.
Okay.
And I took a tape deck with me and a microphone. This is before digital was really catching on.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm going to go there and I'm going to interview Star Wars celebrities. And I'm going to put together, I'm going to put together a show that we can air on WCKG the weekend Revenge of the Sith opens in theaters.
Okay.
So I had this all figured out.
Yeah. You found a way to get it in. But okay. So you were going to interview people. Did you?
Yes. So yeah, I did have media credentials.
Okay, good.
Yes, I did. But I didn't have any ins or nobody set me up with anything. So I just went into the autograph hall before it opened to the public with the media credentials. I had early access to the hall.
Yeah.
And I just stood there and watched as the celebrities are walking in. Peter Mayhew, who played Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Dave Prowse, who's Darth Vader. Anthony Daniels, C-3PO. The late, great Carrie Fisher. It was just like, oh, my God. And so some of them would talk to me.
Another moment you had to keep your cool.
I had to keep my cool.
Yeah.
And some of them would talk to me, And so I recorded these interviews with them. Warwick Davis, in particular, really took a liking to us.
Yeah.
Wicket, the Ewok.
Yes. Oh.
That's who that is. Kenny Baker, who I also talked to, he was R2-D2.
He was R2-D2.
I interviewed him.
Thank you for schooling me.
Yes. I interviewed Ray Park, who's Darth Maul. All these actors, Daniel Logan, who is young Boba Fett, who's a guy who's actually become a really good friend of mine. So I put all this together, and while I was gone, Steve Dahl on WCKG just ripped me a new one. Oh, he's off at the Star Wars convention. What a nerd, What a nerd.
Well, that's the Triumph the Insult Dog clip. You are a huge nerd, right?
Yes, it was a lot of that kind
now
of
Now Conan
vibe.
Makes a lot of money with those fandoms. I'm sorry. Keep going.
So I came back even. There was this the sales exec, Heidi, and she saw me in the hallway. She gave me a hug. She thought I would be so shattered by the fact that Steve Dahl spent 3 days ripping on me. But I had a show.
Yeah.
And I sold it. We got a sponsor on it. And we ran it on the Saturday the film came out. And, of course, I hyped the crap out of it. I called Rob Feeder. I did all of this stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was super excited about it. And I had so much fun putting that together. It was just an hour of Star Wars stuff. And I had so much fun putting that together and playing with all the Star Wars sound effects and all this, which I had been collecting, for years. I'd been just, going through the old VHS tapes, and I would phase reverse the sound to try to pick out dialogue and sound effects and all, trying to deconstruct the film, And so then when it came time to actually put all of those sounds to practical use, I had the best time. And so then the show came and went, and, time passes. And
how was it received when it aired?
I guess okay.
Yeah.
I
mean, okay.
I think they aired it on a few CBS radio stations.
Oh, so, cool.
I mean, I think it went out there.
Yeah.
And so, but I just had fun doing it,
Yeah.
And so that led me to start doing more things produced programming on the air.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did a show, Led Zeppelin show, cool. Where you know they let me play the bootlegs, so I was doing that.
Nice.
I was heavily into collecting all sort of underground recordings back then, live shows, all kind of things, and I had so much Led Zeppelin, and thought people would enjoy it. People did enjoy it. I did that show for like 3 years, and so it just got me into doing more things on the air, like in a produced fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the podcasting then sort of came back to my – it came back into my inbox when Wendy – Wendy was off the air because she had to get knee surgery, knee replacement.
Oh.
And she was doing it at the hospital just up north here, Weiss Memorial.
Yeah.
And so that's like an hour drive from my house, and she was in the hospital for like a week. And so I would drive home to my house in the suburbs. Then I would drive all the way back downtown, usually with my boys.
Yeah.
And we'd go visit mom in the hospital and hang out with her, watch TV in her hospital room or whatever, and then drive back home. And I did that like every day for a couple weeks, it seemed like, or at least a week. And because Wendy wasn't on the air at that time, I would always listen to her on Steve Dahl's show when I was driving home.
Okay.
During my commute.
Yeah.
So I had nothing to listen to. And I saw this podcast, The Force Cast.
Okay? The Force Cast.
And it just started. Like, it was like 4 months old. And it was hosted by these two guys, Jason and Pete from Cleveland. And I didn't have an iPod or anything like that. So I burned them onto CDs.
Oh, I remember doing that.
Yeah. So I would listen to the shows on CDs as I was driving back to the burbs, get my boys, drive over to Weiss Memorial, visit with me. And so I had something to listen to. And I was like, after about a week of like, I heard everything that these guys had done at that point, and I really liked them. I'm mm-hmm. like, these guys are good. They got good chemistry and stuff. They just... I know what they're trying to achieve here.
But you also knew what they were missing.
Right? Yes. Yeah. But they're coming up just a little short.
Yeah.
So after that, I fired off an email to those guys offering my help. And the two guys, Jason and Pete, were resistant. There was a website manager, this guy, Dustin.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really interested in what I had to offer because I sent him clips from that radio show I did.
Yeah.
And he thought he was blown away by the quality of it all and definitely wanted me on board. But Jason and Pete in Cleveland were like, they were just starting to get some traction going and building things. And then all of a sudden, cocky Chicago radio guy is coming, you know, blowing.
And they're not open to the new ideas because it's their thing. Right. Yeah. There's that territorial thing. But so
it felt that way.
Yeah.
But there was this event happening in L.A. to celebrate the 20th anniversary of Star Wars. And I just thought it would be cool to know people at this.
Yeah.
Because it seemed like when I'd go to those conventions, to me, it felt like everyone knew each other. It was like these communities, you know, it's like they're all like best buddies. And again, I'm the square peg, you know, not fitting in. So I thought, well, maybe I could fit in at the convention. Just go over to their booth or whatever and say, hey, I'm Jimmy Mack. You know, and, oh, hey, nice to meet you. Nice to meet you guys. I just thought it would be fun. Nice way to meet people or whatever.
Yeah.
By that time now, that was like 4 months after I first started to offer my services to help them with their show. And the help I did was basically editing and producing bumpers and like making it sound real sleek and professional because I liked what they were doing. I didn't want to mess with what they were doing. That was like my favorite podcast and I didn't want to step on their toes. I just wanted to make them sound better.
Yeah.
And so after about 4 months of that, we started to develop something of a relationship. But then when we got to LA, it was me and my brother and Jason and Pete, but it was Jason who we really connected with big time.
Yeah.
And this guy, the sense of humor on him and the laugh is like, you just want to do anything you can do to make this guy
infectious.
Keep laughing.
Yeah.
Infectious. Oh my God. So you want to do everything in your power to make this guy laugh. And that just sort of became the theme of that whole weekend. We were running ragged around this convention center. And, you know, it was a lot of fun getting to know each other and stuff and being around people who share that kind of passion for Star Wars.
Yeah.
Because I always felt like I was sort of on an island as far as that was concerned. None of my friends, all of my friends love Star Wars, but none of them were
not
on the level
not
I was
in the
at.
Way
they
you
weren't
do,
as,
right?
as obsessive and passionate about it as I was.
So you felt like you found
everything.
Your people.
I felt like I found my people. So I worked with those guys on that show, just trying to make their show the best it could be. And then I would do little specials of my own. Mm. You know? And around 2008 now, I've really become kind of established with their show. The website owner is flying me out to Japan to go out to a big Star Wars event out there. And within weeks of that happening, Pete, the co-host of the show, announces to us that he's quitting the show. And so it's just like, oh, God, what are we going to do? I tried to get Pete to stay. He didn't want – he was getting married. He was going to start a family, all this stuff. Didn't have time for podcasting anymore. And Jason was still pretty much gung-ho about it.
Yeah.
And he was always the driving force in the whole thing. And we were talking on the phone one time, and the words just kind of came out of my mouth. I said, well, do you want me to co-host with you? And he goes, oh, my God, would you?
And like I was he was like, waiting for you to say it?
Yeah, because we didn't know if the show was going to continue.
Uh-huh.
You know, it came down to that.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like the show wasn't making any money. We were working for another website. So if the show was making money, it certainly didn't trickle down to us. And
what was the website?
It was called TheForce.net.
Okay.
And so we just wanted to keep it going because we believed there was a future for podcasting. And we were really proud of the work we had done and the foundation we had established. We basically invented Star Wars podcasting, I think.
And it seems like it.
It was like very much like sports radio, the way we do it, where it's like, you know, everyone understands the language and instead of watching games, they're watching shows or movies. And you know the characters, you know the inside scoop on stuff. It's that kind of energy.
That's a great comparison.
That surrounds. Well,
yeah.
It's very appropriate. And, you know, there could be other elements of different sort of types of radio in there, but I think it's the sports radio. Just instead of sports, we're talking about Star Wars.
You know? And it's the communities of the fandoms,
that help,
you know, drive the thing.
That's
right?
What it's all about.
Yeah.
And so being able to connect with the community has been huge. So Pete said he was leaving. I said I'd fill in.
Yeah.
But we knew there would be an issue probably with the website. Like they would want to have an audition process and all of this.
Oh, gosh.
But Pete signed off and then I signed on the next week. We never said anything about it. It just was business as usual.
Uh-huh.
There was never any big announcement. You know, the new co-host is Jimmy Mack. There was never anything like that.
We just
acted like, you know, it was just business as usual. And this went on for about a month. And, yeah, I remember we went to an event then in Plano, Texas. And the website manager goes to me. He's like, yeah, so we're really thinking about kicking off the look for a co-host in earnest here pretty soon. I said, oh, is that right? I said, well, good luck with that. And that was the only time I ever talked about it with him. I stayed right where I was, and there was no audition for any other co-host.
Somebody told him, no, we're not going to do that. We don't need to do that.
That trip I took to Japan really helped establish me because that's where I met all the Lucasfilm people.
Oh, cool.
And guys like Dave Filoni, who I hit it off really big with him. We had a fast friendship. And some other people with Lucasfilm, Mark Hamill. That was the first time I interviewed him. And once you interview Mark Hamill, then everyone wants to talk to you.
I didn't even know that until now, and I want to talk to you more.
So,
but yeah,
I met Mark in the bathroom backstage at the convention center.
Yeah,
I walked in there, and I was like, somebody's smoking in here, you know. And out from the back stall comes Mark throwing the cigarette into the toilet. He's like, hey, what's going on, man? And I'm like, hey, Mark Hamill. Oh, my God.
Hey, Mark Hamill.
Yeah, I was like, I've been wanting to talk to you for a long time. And then he's like, oh, my God, what is this thing? And it was those hand dryers where it's like the blade where you slide your hand in.
Oh, yeah.
We've never seen that before Japan.
Uh-huh.
This is 2008 Japan. This is high-tech stuff.
Where you see your skin moving as you put it through.
So me and Hamill are looking at it. He's like, well, how do you make this work? And so we're like, I stick my finger in it.
That's actually a really good Mark Hamill impression.
So I stick my hand in the thing. It starts. I pull it out real fast. I think all you have to do is put your hands in there. We're playing with this thing. And so we get done with all of that. And I just said, hey, Mark, I flew all the way to Japan to interview you. Do you think we can do that? And he's like, yeah, sure. Okay.
We just experienced hand dryers for the first time. Yeah,
but I wasn't really sure, like, it was resonating with him. I think he was just saying, yeah, and like, I'm blowing me off or whatever. Because I had heard rumors that he was charging $50,000 per interview and stuff.
Oh, my.
And needless to say, that was not part of my budget because the podcast certainly wasn't making any money back then. But I walked out there and somebody came running up to me and says, do you have time to talk to Mark Hamill? And I said, do I have time?
Do you have time? Did you take a pause for a second?
I've been waiting my whole life to talk to Mark Hamill. Let's go. And he's like, hey, you know, and it's like, after a few jokes about the hand dryer in the bathroom, we got into it and had a really good conversation. And I got, so, you know, that got me a lot of attention and stuff.
Had you talked to him since then?
Yeah, yeah.
A few times?
The second time I had laryngitis.
Oh, fun.
I had awful laryngitis and had to whisper some. And luckily, I had my co-host Jason with me, and so he picked up the ball and did most of the heavy lifting in that. But Mark he felt terrible for me. But I mean, I couldn't talk. It was the worst laryngitis I ever had in my life. And I think I blew it out yelling at George Lucas the night before. That's a whole nother story, though.
That's another episode.
I go, GL's in the house. And I swear he gave me, he said, number one, he like that, you know, put his finger up in the air. But some people say he put a different finger up in the air. But I thought he was saying number one. But I've been around George Lucas a couple of times, brief, you know, not for several years. But I did get a little one-on-one time with him at this junket at the Four Seasons. That was a charity event for the Gene Siskel Film Center.
Oh, cool.
And so I got invited there to go and, you know, stand on line with Bill Zwecker and our own Dean Richards.
Yeah.
And Hosea Sanders, or is it Saunders? I can't remember. And, you know, a few other entertainment reporters and me. You know, from the Rebel Force Radio podcast. Yeah. But, and so, you know, I got to ask George a few questions. But one of them was, you know, hey, you keep coming back to Star Wars all the time. Why do you do it? And he just kind of looked at me like I was an idiot. And he goes, because it's fun.
It's a good soundbite, though.
It was a great soundbite. The better soundbite, though, and Zwecker wrote about this in the Sun Times, was when I approached George, I was holding a Zoom audio recorder.
It's I know what those are.
Digital recorder.
Yeah.
And it has these two little microphones on the front.
Yep.
But for some reason, when people look at that, they think it's a taser.
It looks like one, though.
Well,
I know what it looks like. But
and
yeah.
So, and George Lucas, and this was the time when the meme was popular and hot. George Lucas comes up to me and goes, hey, what's that, a taser? Don't tase me, bro.
Oh, no.
He said, don't tase me, bro.
Oh, no.
And Zwecker wrote about it in the Sun Times. In the Sun Times. He's like, George Lucas's sense of humor was on display when he approached a young reporter. Stupid reporter. But, you know, so that was just like, you know, and I've been to Skywalker Ranch a dozen times. Oh. Maybe I have a hat on my Skywalker Ranch.
I saw
Ranch
that. Ride. So yeah. What's that like?
I bought that they have a little general store there.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's just like this incredibly beautiful Northern California, Marin County is just gorgeous. It's just gorgeous. And my visits to Skywalker Ranch really opened me up to that whole area. To where I would go on hikes on Big Rock Ridge surrounding the ranch. I would hike up Mount Tamalpais in Marin, which is the highest point above sea level in that area. the East Peak.
Yeah.
I've been up there. And you know, here in Illinois, we have no hills.
Oh, we're flatlanders. Yeah.
Total flatlanders. Yeah. You know, Illinois is the flattest state in the country next to one other. Do you know which other state is flatter?
The next one Iowa?
No.
Indiana?
It's not in the Midwest.
It's not in the Midwest.
Believe it or not. Yeah.
Is it? Oh, this is going to take me a little while.
Well, I'm not going to give you one more guess.
Okay. One more guess.
Yeah.
Flat. It's not in the Midwest.
It's not in the Midwest.
Is it East Coast?
It is.
Is it Massachusetts?
No, it's Florida.
Really?
Florida is the flattest state in the nation.
No, it makes sense. Because it's sinking.
It's all sinking swamp.
Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, but I've been out, you know, so I've been out there to Skywalker to just like visit, mm-hmm. To actually be involved in like PR functions and junkets.
Yeah.
And sometimes just eat lunch, you know, or just hang out. You know, those are the funnest ones, though.
Yeah.
You know? And if you're with people who really know their way around the place, they can show you things that it's pretty impressive, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
A little bit in some of the buildings, some of the things are a little dated, you know.
Okay.
You can tell they need kind of a tech refresh here and there, but they do have Skywalker Sound there.
Yeah.
Which is its own separate building. It looks like a vineyard building in the middle of a vineyard. And that's got some high-tech stuff in there.
Really?
In Skywalker Sound. Oh, my God. And there was a time when I was kind of, you know, would have liked to have worked there. But it's hard. I got my roots were too deep. I had young kids.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Wendy, she's got a career here. It's just I could never, like, pack up and move out to Marin. One time I said that to somebody who's an executive at Lucasfilm.
Yeah.
And she just went, oh, interesting. And I'm like, oh, I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
You know, maybe I'll get some call or something. But it never happened.
Gotcha.
And I'm glad it never happened. That would be a tough choice to make, man.
But
work on movies at Skywalker Ranch.
That's unreal. The nerd in me loves that.
I'm envious of those people, too.
But you mentioned this a little bit ago that you saw a future in podcasting. That medium could be taking off. What were the things that you saw early on that you thought were going to do that? And then what happened?
Well, I just saw it emerging as like a legitimate broadcast medium. I didn't think it was going to be amateur hour like I did initially.
Uh-huh.
And I thought to myself, well, it's going to develop into some kind of business. This is pretty exciting to be on the ground floor.
Yeah.
Because in radio, you know, radio is like ancient. This radio station alone, WGN's 100 years
old. Over 100 years old, yeah.
So, I mean, it's like, you know, the ground floor, that's we're up on top of the skyscraper now in radio. But with podcasts, it felt like a really level playing field. And it felt like a place where you could do things. You could push the limits, mm-hmm. do things outside the box. You could just be as creative as you wanted to be. But I always try to apply broadcast standards into just naturally.
Yeah.
You know, I always try to apply those broadcast standards into the podcast I produce and treat it like it's a radio show. Take everything I've learned from radio and put it into the podcast, see what's going to happen. And I knew with a guy like Jason Swank, who is my partner and co-host on Rebel Force Radio. We moved on from the Force cast around 2012, we decided to start our own thing.
Yeah.
Because George Lucas sold his company to Disney, and we knew there was going to be a lot of things on the horizon then, and we just wanted to be in charge of our own thing.
Right.
There was a little bit of friction between us and the website managers over lack of transparency about the money that does come in. Where is it going?
Yeah.
It certainly has not come down to us, and we're putting a lot of work into this thing.
Yeah.
And we just thought we were seeing streams of ad revenue starting to appear on the horizon,
mm-hmm.
first via live reads and full show sponsorships, But
and distribution's growing at that time too, right?
Distribution was getting really big at that
point. Because what, Apple started making it more of a their thing right around that time?
Yeah,
that
Apple, for all the good they do for podcasting, they also do a lot of bad.
Yeah.
But because they get too much like this, they want to be the dominant
thing. Yeah.
And they go to... Sometimes they go to lengths that I don't think is beneficial for the industry.
No,
but you
guys are there. Marin is starting his around that time too, right?
Well, I guess he was like 2009.
2009.
Yeah. So we started in 2006.
Yeah. So you get to say that to him when people tell him he's a godfather of it. And you'd be like, no, I was your first. I was your first.
No.
But you had him, you had Hardwick doing his, right?
Chris Nerdist. Was coming on. Yeah. And Kevin Smith started in 2008.
Yeah.
And so like these are guys with some, you know, showbiz clout, and they're getting involved in podcasting and helping legitimize the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you see all this stuff happening and you see the emergence of a broadcasting industry.
Yeah.
And also then the accessibility.
Yes.
The hardware, all of those things started to happen where people could go to the store and buy like a podcasting kit.
Right.
And go home. I don't use any of that stuff. I never use anything specifically designed for podcasting. I always use broadcast equipment. I always have.
It's for the better. Trust me.
Some of that
stuff. Someone who did the other stuff, yes.
I look at some of that stuff that they claim is like a snowball Blue Yeti mic and all that. And to me, I look at that stuff and I see a toy.
Yeah.
I see a toy. I need a real microphone. And so I have those snobby standards when it comes to gear and stuff. But on the other side of the coin, a 14-year-old kid can mow some lawns, save some money, and go buy this podcasting gear, plug it all in according to the instructions, bing, bang, boom, the kid's podcasting. It's not that hard. The accessibility has become so accessible. The accessibility has become so accessible. Anybody can do it now, and everyone is doing it now.
And I've heard Conan O'Brien talk about who has gotten into podcasting in the last couple of years.
Oh, yeah.
Got in with Sirius, making it even bigger. But like he even will say that the landscape of show business has changed so much where
sure
anyone
has.
Can do it, but it takes doing it differently than someone else and making it interesting. And like you've done, you've built a community, right? Or you've been a part of a community and built something around your podcast.
Well, that's the key is the interaction with the audience.
Yeah.
Making them part of something you're doing. And there's these tools out there that help you connect with the audience and help you make money.
Mm-hmm.
We use a website called Patreon.
Yeah.
And Patreon is a website where you can connect with your audience and they support you financially. And in return, you supply them with content.
Yeah,
or other perks that you can't get just by downloading and listening to the podcast. And so I started doing that stuff like in earnest around 2017.
Yeah.
And that has turned out to be an outstanding source of income and a great way to be interactive with the audience. And so I've taken our supporters, some of them, and turn them into like notable personalities within the community.
That's cool.
You know, where they can sort of be in the spotlight.
Yeah.
And that was a really, really good thing that I did by doing that.
It just feel rewarding too, though, right?
It makes more people feel like they're part of the show.
Yeah.
And so I do a thing once a week with our VIP tier where I will co-host a show with one of the VIPs.
Nice.
And by doing that, some of them have done it repeatedly over the years.
Mm-hmm.
And so you start to develop chemistry with them. and you start anticipating what they're going to talk about, and you know what you're going to get into with these people. Well, this guy's going to bring up some serious stuff. This guy's going to be funny. This guy's going to be irreverent. This, you know, and so you start developing then all of these, like, these audience members who are then becoming viable co-hosts on their own. So if, like, Jason ever flakes on me, I can...
You've got a stable, right? You've got a bench.
I don't anticipate that ever happening, but yeah. So it's turned in, and so it's actually turned into a corporation of its own.
That's incredible.
It's an actual business entity now, and other big revenue sources have been YouTube, merchandising, live appearances, auto ads.
Really?
Auto ads. I'm building my own commercial breaks in the shows, and they get filled automatically by national advertisers, radio commercials, you know. It just gets planted into our show.
That's actually kind of what we do on the other side of this building is selling those ads.
So that's
really interesting.
Yeah.
So there is a whole generation, and these are kind of the part of the audience that we're talking to right now that grew up listening to podcasts. And probably have that interest, whereas you grew up interested in radio. Yeah. I grew up interested in radio, too.
Mm-hmm.
What advice do you have for a young, and you've probably talked to young people about this before, that are interested in what you do and want to get in on it? Like, what would you say to them?
Well, if we're talking about podcasting, I would recommend just diving in.
Yeah.
Don't overthink it. Just dive in and record a conversation with you and your best friend. Find some subject matter that is something that you feel like you can be passionate about and keep talking about week after week after week, and record those conversations. And if you don't like the first one, record another one and record another one until you get to a point where you feel like you can then launch it as a podcast. And if you do launch a podcast, consistency is key. You'll never see any growth if you're inconsistent. So release a show at least once a week, same day, same time. Keep doing that week after week after week. It can be a grind, but you'll start to notice that your audience is growing.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the consistency. If you're releasing like two shows a month and they come out whenever, willy-nilly, you'll never establish that footprint you need to establish.
Because they are expecting the consistency.
Yeah.
Right?
Because then people start to schedule their week around your show.
Yeah.
And that's what you want. It has to be that appointment listening. And people need to know when to schedule that appointment. So I find that we release our shows on Friday nights, 6 p.m.
Okay.
Central. But we also do have an international audience, too. So I can't look at things like, well, the best time to release a show is from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. But it's like, what time zone?
Right.
So it's like I can't pay attention to that. I just have to, you know, I just found my comfort zone, the time when I'm going to release the show, and I've made sure I put out the show at that time, and I've been doing it for almost 20 years.
And what's interesting just about when you're releasing that, your listeners have the whole weekend then to listen to it.
That's the nice part.
Right?
Now, like, some people do, they unplug, though,
mm-hmm.
for the weekend, like – they don't have those routines necessarily where they're stuck in the car commuting.
Or they're mowing the lawn.
Well,
or
see,
they're
that's
working
the other
out.
Thing. People do tell us mowing the lawn is a big podcast.
I am someone who does that, yes.
When people mow the lawn, they're listening to podcasts. When they walk the dog, they're listening to podcasts.
Right.
When they go to the gym. So then you start discovering, oh, wow, you know, we're just accompanying people throughout their whole weekend.
Yeah.
And they because they have the whole weekend to listen to the show, I don't believe that they feel the pressure to fit it all in. They listen to it, you know, a little here, a little there, a little there. It's a two-hour show every week consistently.
Yeah.
So, it just keeps them, it gives them programming to consume throughout the whole weekend. And then there's the people who will wait till Monday to listen just because they like to consume the podcast as part of their commute. That's their routine.
Yes.
So I'm more like that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm more the routine guy where I like to have the shows going while I'm commuting. And
I'm with you on that, where I have like my schedule for the week, right? Like, yeah. I know what's coming out on Monday. I'm going to get those three in on Monday and so forth. But
that's the key. You want to become part of people's schedules.
I am so sorry. I've taken up so much
you
of your time.
And you certainly
I think
have.
I need to pay you for it.
I would be really upset if we were talking about someone else other than me. But because we are talking about me, I thought the time just flew.
It, you know what? It did, though. And I really appreciate you doing this.
Yeah,
for anyone that wants to, now that they've listened to you, mm-hmm. they want to find your show, where can they find
you? Well, the podcast is anywhere you could find podcasts.
Yeah.
But the main place is rebelforceradio.com.
Mm-hmm.
That's our website, and it's the place where we keep all of our stuff organized. That's, you know, sometimes I've been asked this, you know, why do we have a website when it's really the podcast? That's all people want. They don't want the website. I said,
No.
We have to keep our history intact
exactly.
in one place.
You need a home base.
Yeah.
You know.
So it just takes the pressure off. Like our YouTube numbers are but a mere fraction of what our audio podcast numbers are.
Yeah.
And it's been a little frustrating because we can't really crack the YouTube code. We can't really
which is so much algorithm.
The algorithms don't like us. The precious YouTube algorithms don't like us. And the thing is that's why I think a lot of people who do have success on YouTube, sometimes I think it's artificially inflated success based on these silly algorithms.
Yes.
Because we have gotten on the wave a couple of times and seen huge numbers.
My bad.
Oh, do you have somewhere you have to
go? No, it's my take your medication alarm.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Do you need to bend
No,
over?
I'm good.
Okay.
I'm good.
All right. You got to drop your trousers and all right. Okay. But it's those algorithms. So that's been frustrating for me.
Yeah.
Because YouTube shows the numbers of views and stuff. And I look at those numbers, I'm like, gosh, that's like it's so beneath
it's,
where
it's
we're
not reflective
at.
Of it.
It's
right?
not where we're at. It's not, it doesn't represent our reach, but, YouTube is there, you know, Spotify, the Apple Podcasts, Audible.
Yep.
We're everywhere. We're everywhere. Awesome. So,
well, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, brother.
Yeah.
That was really fun.
Yeah. Check out careervision.org to learn more about what they do, and WGNRadio.com for what both Jimmy and I do. But thank you so much. Really appreciate you doing this.
Thanks. It was great. All right. You'll hear from me again during a commercial break, I guess.